For Friday, May 26, 2006, this is Free Speech Radio News. I'm Aura Bogado. British Prime Minister Tony Blair is in Washington, where he meets with President Bush. We'll hear from Oaxaca City, where human rights defenders protest against femicide. And as Colombian voters set to go to the polls Sunday, we'll take a look at the candidates. All that and more after the headlines.
I'm Monica Lopez with the headlines for Free Speech Radio News. The Senate has voted 78-15 to confirm General Michael Hayden as the next director of the Central Intelligence Agency. Hayden previously oversaw the National Security Agency at the beginning of its massive domestic spying program. The appointment marks the first time in a quarter of a century that a military figure will head the CIA. In an attempt to ease tensions in the Gaza Strip, the Palestinian Hamas-led government ordered its special forces off Gaza streets in the wake of clashes with the Fatah movement, which has stirred fears of civil war. Manar Jabrin reports.
Friday's order came a day after Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas gave Hamas a 10-day ultimatum to either back a proposal for statehood that implicitly recognizes Israel or face a referendum on the issue. Clashes between Hamas and Fatah have become more frequent since last week's deployment of a new security force consisting of 3,000 Hamas loyalists. Clashes between the newly formed force and the security forces under the control of the president have killed 10 people and injured several others. Despite the calls from President Abbas to disband this force, Prime Minister Ismail Haniyeh said on Thursday that the Palestinian government is set to complete in the coming weeks the process of integrating the new force into the existing Palestinian police. For FSR and from imemc.org in Palestine, I am Manar Jibrin.
Peacekeeping forces from New Zealand will soon join their Australian counterparts in the tiny island nation of East Timor. Tensions have been escalating there since 600 Timorese soldiers were dismissed after protesting discrimination within the ranks. Groups of former soldiers formed a rebel faction and began launching attacks on pro-government troops and police. At least 20 have been killed and several thousand have been displaced by the fighting. Australian peacekeepers arrived in the Timorese capital yesterday to de-escalate the situation. East Timor's Foreign Minister José Ramos Horta has indicated the possibility of peace talks between rival groups as early as this weekend. In Nepal, the government began peace talks with Maoist rebels today. Maoists entered into an alliance with the country's seven political parties when King Gyanendra still held absolute power. Observers and government negotiators seem confident of a breakthrough. Heavy fighting in Afghanistan continues. Reuters reports that at least five people were killed in a clash between Taliban militants and Afghan police. Fighting in Afghanistan has killed some 300 people since last week in what has been described as the worst violence since the 2001 invasion. Anti-war protesters have been arrested in Olympia, Washington, as they try to block U.S. Army convoys headed for Iraq. Mark Taylor Canfield reports.
Equipment for the 3rd Striker Brigade, headquartered at Fort Lewis, is being loaded onto ships at the Port of Olympia as troops prepare to leave for Iraq on their second deployment. Anti-war protesters have continued to commit acts of civil disobedience in an attempt to block the military vehicles' access to port facilities. Demonstrators say they oppose the use of the public port to support what they call an illegal and immoral war. Their repeated attempts to force the Port Commission to stop accepting military shipments since 2004 have been unsuccessful. The military convoys are scheduled to continue for another week, and protesters say they'll be back for more demonstrations. This is Mark Taylor Canfield reporting for Free Speech Radio News in Seattle.
The South Central farmers and their supporters continue their encampment on the nation's largest urban farm. After increased pressure from local and international media, L.A. Mayor Antonio Villaraigosa finally commented on the farm, saying that current landowner Ralph Horowitz should bring the $16 million selling price down closer to the roughly $5 million he paid for it 2 years ago. As people inside the farm gathered past midnight to strategize for a possible eviction and arrests, supporter Daryl Hanna spoke to Free Speech Radio News.
Everybody who's here, you know, especially who's staying here, has to be ready for that because it is civil disobedience and everyone really has to know what to do in that case. And so I think it's right for everyone to be prepared. Whether that happens or not, I don't know. Hopefully it won't. We're really working hard to try to find some way to have a resolution. and to really save this place and not have to be evicted for it to all end up where everybody's happy.
And those are the headlines for Free Speech Radio News. I'm Monica Lopez.
British Prime Minister Tony Blair is in Washington today, where he met with President Bush at the White House. Both acknowledged that the war in Iraq is not proceeding as smoothly as they had hoped and admitted regret for incidents like the prisoner abuse at Abu Ghraib. During his visit, Tony Blair called for UN reform and stressed the need for enhanced multilateralism. FSRN's Anastasia Gnezditska reports from Washington, D.C.
When talking about the issue of Iraq, which was the key on their agenda, both Bush and Blair stated again that they are not outlining any specific timetable for withdrawal from Iraq.
It's hard to have a command and control system with an Iraqi army when you don't have a defense minister. And so Mr. Maliki's going to have to pick one soon. And then our commanders will gauge as to whether or not the command and control structure is sufficient to be able to enable the Iraqis to take more of the fight.
Tony Blair, however, sounded more optimistic about the possibility of imminent pullout.
I think it's possible for the Iraqi security forces to take control progressively of their country. That's exactly the strategy we've outlined at the beginning. And I think it's possible to happen in the way that Prime Minister Maliki said.
Both Tony Blair and George Bush face low approval ratings in their countries. That's why both of them stress the issues that are important domestically. In particular, Tony Blair addressed the need for reform of the United Nations as a way of reviving effective multilateralism in international affairs, a call that would likely be popular with his constituency at home.
Prime Minister, you've both talked a little about the UN. I know that you believe the UN needs vigorous leadership. Is that a job application? And if not,
wait a minute.
Do you both have a sense? Do you have someone in mind? And if not, how are you going to get the reform of the UN you want to see?
No, and I'm not sure is the answer. What we want to do is to make sure that the UN is an effective instrument of multilateral action. The fact is there are multiple problems in the world. They require the international community to respond on a collective basis, but you've got to have an effective set of multilateral institutions to do that. And that's true whether you're tackling global poverty or dealing with issues like Iran.
The current White House, despite the close relationship between Mr. Bush and Mr. Blair, remains wary of getting entangled in what it would see as too much multilateralism. Victoria Sampson, research analyst at the Center for Defense Information.
Multilateralism would be great. However, I really think Prime Minister Blair was playing to the British audiences in regards to that. There's so much hostility towards the United States for its perceived unilateralism over the past 5 years that I think it's his way of doing a course correction. Tony Blair has been very heavily criticized by people domestically and abroad for the British insistence on sticking with the United States with our policy in Iraq, come hell or high water. And it seems that what he's trying to do is trying to deflect some of that criticism and an attempt to try to say, well, even though the United States is insisting on doing things one way, we have our own policy and we're promoting a more multilateral approach.
That said, one aspect that both leaders agreed on was certain missteps in conducting the war in Iraq.
Saying bring it on, kind of tough talk, you know, that sent the wrong signal to people. I learned some lessons about expressing myself maybe in a little more sophisticated manner, wanted dead or alive, that kind of talk. I think in certain parts of the world it was misinterpreted. You know, I think the biggest mistake that's happened so far, at least from our country's involvement in Iraq, is Abu Ghraib. We've been paying for that for a long period of time.
For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Anastasia Gnezditska in Washington, D.C.
Germany's Foreign Intelligence Service, the BND, has been accused of spying on journalists. A leaked report commissioned by a parliamentary committee criticized the BND for overstepping its bounds by spying on the press and for using journalists to snitch on each other. Since the 1980s, the BND has spied on a number of major German news publications, but the BND says its actions were purely for self-protection. Cinnamon Apard reports from Berlin.
In 1993, editor of the news magazine Focus, Erich Schmidt-Ehrenboom, published a book about the BND which raised the ire of the agency. But General Secretary of the German Journalists Union, Ulrike Merz-Franzen, says he was not the only one placed under surveillance.
When we think about the fact that all colleagues and all persons who have been in contact with the one author, Schmidt-Ehnbaum, in the years 1993 to 1995, that all these persons have been surveyed by the BND, we have to speak about more than 90 persons.
When other newspapers reported on Schmidt-Ehnbaum's predicament, many of them were also placed under surveillance, often by other journalists enlisted by the BND. Lukas Wallruf is a journalist working for the newspaper Die Tageszeitung in their parliament office in Berlin.
Many journalists spied on their own colleagues, and there's a big grey zone also among the journalists, what is according to the journalistic ethos and what is not.
The BND defended its action, saying that it was trying to identify leaks to the press from its own department. Ulrike Merx-Franzen from the German Journalists Union.
They should have surveyed the telephones of their own employees, not those of journalists who could have been in contact with them. They damaged the freedom of press in result of a problem they had in their own office.
The German government has condemned the actions of its foreign intelligence service, banning them from using journalists in this manner. Former heads of the BND are waving accusatory fingers at each other, and so far politicians are also passing the buck on taking responsibility for this 25-year scandal. While two news publications, The Stern and Der Spiegel, are considering taking legal action. Journalist Lukas Wallruf.
The problem is that you will always have contacts between journalists and Secret Service people, and there probably will always be a grey zone of where the limits are, what is legal and what is illegal.
The report was made public in Berlin today. Among those who have welcomed its release is opposition Liberal Democrat lawmaker Max Stadler, vice chairman of the Parliament Supervisory Committee. He was speaking on German public radio.
The debate is certainly not over now that the Schäfer report is out, he says. We need to clear up why the government's control mechanisms vis-à-vis the BND's activities were so inefficient, and we have to be clear about measures needed to ensure that there will be no more infringements of freedom of the press in future.
The German Foreign Intelligence Service has just celebrated its 50th anniversary of operation. For Free Speech Radio News in Berlin, I'm Cinnamon Nippard.
Colombian voters head to the polls this Sunday for the country's presidential election. While the South American nation has stood out as the strongest Bush administration ally among a growing trend of leftist leaders in the region, Colombian President Álvaro Uribe remains ahead in the polls and will most likely win a second term. But the recent rise in popularity of leftist candidate Carlos Gaviria opens the possibility of a runoff. From Bogotá, Nicole Carson has more.
Last Sunday, thousands of supporters of the leftist candidate Carlos Gaviria filled Bogota's main plaza as the former senator and constitutional court judge closed his campaign. Unlike his rival, President Álvaro Uribe, Gaviria, a candidate of the new non-traditional party called the Alternative Democratic Polo Party, recognizes the armed conflict plaguing the country, and instead of employing military force, he plans on using state institutions to attack the causes of the conflict. Unlike Uribe, Gaviria supports abortion rights and is deeply opposed to this nation's free trade agreement with the U.S. Carlos Gaviria.
My main work has been to contribute to the consolidation of a political alternative in Colombia. A program, a project very different from that of the president. If we win, my work from the presidency will be to consolidate this proposal. And if we lose, my work continues to be consolidating this proposal so that it will be a challenge for whatever authoritarian movement of the extreme right, like that of Dr. Uribe.
While President Uribe has remained ahead in the polls, some say a recent gain by Gaviria to 20% may cause a runoff. Based on the massive anti-Uribe mobilizations and roadblocks that seized southern Colombia during the past couple weeks, as well as the Constitutional Court's decision to overturn Uribe's peace and justice law for the paramilitaries that are demobilizing, some speculate that these events could bring a surprise on election day. However, analyst Alfredo Rangel says that this is the least violent electoral season in decades and that Gaviria's recent rise in popularity does not put Uribe's re-election at risk.
Sin embargo, lo que están mostrando todas las encuestas...
All the polls in Colombia that are done very scientifically coincide with the general tendencies that give Uribe a victory in the first round, and they place the other candidates very far away from Uribe.
Tension continues in southern Colombia, where thousands of indigenous peoples, Afro-Colombians, and farmers protested the re-election of Uribe and the free trade agreement. At least four people were killed in police repression since May 15th. Alfredo Acosta, the coordinator of 7,000 unarmed NASA Indigenous Guard in northern Cauca, says he will employ Indigenous Guards to ensure safety at the voting booths this Sunday.
We are against the politics of this government and against the re-election of a totalitarian government that fuels the war, an extremist government. To re-elect this government is to ratify a policy of war, of democratic security that has afflicted civilians, families, and that has promoted displacement. We reject their election and the policies of the current government.
However, yesterday the government announced that it will revoke voting booths from rural areas in southern Colombia. Daniel Garcia Peña, who is managing Gaviria's campaign, is extremely concerned.
That in many of these areas are exactly where the Polo Democrático has had important votes in recent elections. The marches that took place last week in Cauca and so forth. So these areas, the government is saying that there are security reasons to move the voting, away from the rural areas into the urban areas, into the cities, which obviously makes it very difficult for people in the countryside to come in and to vote, which is quite ironic because on one side the president is saying that the Seguridad Democrática has been able to pacify the country, but on the other hand, they are in fact alluding to security reasons in order to justify the moving of these voting places.
Another of what Garcia Peña calls dirty campaign tricks is a threatening letter sent around to NGOs and universities threatening Gaviria supporters. The letter reads, quote, "We will struggle with blood and fire against whoever opposes the interest that our legitimate leader continue the presidency," end quote. The letter is signed by a group that calls itself Colombia Free of Communists Armed Group of the ex-AUC. While Garcia Peña says the threatening letter is worrisome, he has turned it over for authorities to investigate. Meanwhile, at least 10 universities have closed down until elections end because of the letter. From Bogota, this is Nicole Carson for Free Speech Radio News.
According to a recent report issued by Mexico's lower house of Congress, an average of 4 women or girls are killed daily in the country, mostly in the states of Mexico, Veracruz, Chiapas, Guerrero, and Mexico City, aside from Ciudad Juarez. The report indicates that Oaxaca takes second place for femicide. Vladimir Flores reports from Oaxaca City, where human rights defenders organized a protest demanding justice for the over 20 women that have been killed in the past 9 months alone.
Around a dozen civil organizations from Oaxaca presented the Federal Chamber of Deputies with media documentation of some cases of violence against women. Although the state and federal governments recognize the gravity of this situation, human rights organizations like Amnesty International say it appears that these crimes continue to go unpunished. Aline Castellanos, member of the women's rights group Colectivo Huaxyacac, comments on this situation.
El resultado de la investigación sobre feminicidios en la República Mexicana llevada a cabo...
The result of the investigation into the femicides in Mexico was carried out by the nation's Congress in 10 states in 2005. It concluded that, yes, there is femicide in Oaxaca. The institution charged with enforcing the law and obtaining justice in Oaxaca are not carrying out the necessary steps to investigate, punish, and prevent violence against women, which in the course of 5 years, between 1999 and 2003, have totaled 352 homicides of women and girls.
The lack of sensitivity and adequate training of the Oaxacan authorities in charge of investigating femicide cases is one of the reasons why many women don't report incidents of aggression, which means very few cases are resolved. Adela Hernandez, whose 30-year-old sister disappeared last year, tells of her experience with the Office of the Special Prosecutor for Crimes Against Women in Oaxaca.
Mi hermana desaparece extrañamente desde el día 21 de agosto hasta la fecha. La Procuraduría no me da...
My sister strangely disappeared on August 21st. Up to the present day, the Office of the Special Prosecutor has not responded in any way to my case. I've received bad treatment, humiliation, because I am guilty of having a sister who is missing, of being a woman who is poor and solitary. It's cause for indignation that women in positions of power have shown much indifference towards cases as that of my sister and other women who have disappeared or have been killed by their husbands. So, it's a situation of despair.
Una situación desesperante.
No más violencia.
200 people, mostly women, marched yesterday afternoon through the streets of Oaxaca City to demand justice for murdered women, which, according to official figures, totaled over 50 in the past year. Also yesterday, the Office of the Special Prosecutor for Crimes Against Women in Oaxaca presented its first report. March participant Ana María Hernández comments.
Today, the special prosecutor gave figures regarding this problematic situation in Oaxaca and made assurances that in the last 16 months they received 26 complaints of gang rape, that almost two women are gang raped a month, every month.
Human rights organizations in Oaxaca will soon participate in work sessions with Amnesty International and in the coming days will present documentation on the extent of violent crime against women in Oaxaca. Oaxaca City, Vladimir Flores, Free Speech Radio News.
This is Will Dog of Ozo Motley, and you're listening to Free Speech Radio News.
African governments have been accused of violating people's rights under the guise of promoting security. In their latest report, human rights watchdog Amnesty International says that although there were indications of progress in some parts of Africa, the situation has remained pathetic and that the international community and the UN are slow to act. Joshua Chilimpa reports from the Amnesty International Africa Region office in Kampala.
The report says that impunity by governments was widespread and that China and Russia stood in the way of action against the perpetrators of human rights abuses due to their economic interest on the African continent. Mchero Kagari, the deputy director of Amnesty International Africa Program, says that the situation in Darfur is one in case where the international community has been slow to act.
Governments have collectively and individually paralyzed international institutions and squandered resources and capacity in misguided military and security strategies. Darfur is the saddest case in point in 2005. 2 million people have been displaced, over 200,000 have died, and 1,000 others have been raped and their atrocities continue unabated. Intermittent attention and feeble action by the United Nations and the African Union fell pathetically short of what was needed in Darfur. China and Russia paralyzed the UN Security Council to protect their oil interests and arms trade with Khartoum over human rights and responsibilities domestically and internationally.
Amnesty International says that they have a team in Central African nation of Chad to ensure that the war in Darfur does not spread to Chad. They are asking the UN to ignore protests from Sudan against the proposed UN deployment. Of the progress that has been made, Amnesty International representatives say they are happy to report that former president of Liberia, Charles Taylor, was transferred to the UN court in Sierra Leone, that Charles Lubanga, a leader of a militia in Congo, was also transferred to The Hague to answer to cases related to war crimes, and that the leaders of the Lord Resistance Army operating in northern Uganda were indicted for war crimes. The Human Rights Organization also wants the impunity enjoyed by governments to end. The chairperson of the Eastern Horn of Africa Human Rights Defenders, Mr. Hassan Shah Sheikh, says the torture by governments in Africa does not bring about peace.
It has been proved time in the world that torture
That's why we had a convention banning it. We'll never contribute any substantive stability of the criminal's mind about what they intend to do. But proper intelligence, proper investigation method, and proper resource devoted to that and collaborations among the governments of the world could also mitigate about those kinds of activities. But torture in any way will never have any contribution to the upheldment of the rule of law. I advise governments of the world to be true to what they have signed, to be true to their domestic laws, and to be true to the international conventions to which they are subscribed to. There's no way going back of this achievement, and deploying a civilized way of upholding the rule of law will ultimately serve the justice and security for all.
At the launch of the Amnesty International report on Wednesday, Mcheru Kagali had this final word to the UN and the international community.
The killings, rape and displacement in Darfur must stop. The Darfur Peace Agreement contains strong human rights provisions that offer a way ahead, if properly implemented. But for it to work, the UN Security Council must urgently deploy UN peacekeepers and must not allow itself to be manipulated by Sudan. Pending their deployment, the African monitors must be supported by the international community to carry out their work. There is a particular responsibility on the Arab states to encourage Sudan to concede to a UN operation. Arab leaders do a disservice to themselves and their people when they use solidarity as a shield to avoid their human rights responsibilities. More than ever, the world needs countries with powers and influence to behave with responsibility and respect for human rights. Governments must stop playing games with human rights.
For Free Speech Radio News, this is Joshua Charimpa reporting from Kampala, Uganda.
And that will do it for today's newscast. Join us this Monday, Memorial Day, as Free Speech Radio News brings you a special documentary in memoriam produced by Ankayala Kelly.
United States Marines illegally landed their troops on January 16, 1893, in an attempt to annex Hawaii by installing a puppet government.
We are still bitter over how they treated our queen, imprisoned her, and how they took over our government.
The Hawaiians of the 19th century, early 20th century, any of the ones that had anything to do with trying to resist or stop the United States taking Hawaii against their will, they're not resting in peace. We feel their presence all the time.
I'm a genealogical descendant of the first people that walked these islands. And I think it's important for every generation that we remind them that they too are descended. It gives us a very special relationship to the Aina, Aina meaning land.
A native burial is always a target of militarization expansion, of hotel expansion for the tourists. So even you as a Hawaiian, you can get evicted as Hawaiian even when you pass on. We're always at the threat of being evicted from our homelands, even when we're underground.
That's this Monday, a special documentary in memoriam on FSRN. Free Speech Radio News is a worker-run collective. Our newscast is produced by Simba Russo and Monica Lopez. Shannon Young is our headlines editor. Washington editor is Leanne Caldwell. Our technical production team at KPFA in Berkeley includes Eric Klein and Antonio Ortiz. You can find archives of this newscast or any other newscast or documentary online at fsrn.org. You can also email us your questions, comments, and story ideas to comments@fsrn.org. From KPFK in LA, I'm Ara Bogado.